This is Fuel.
Fuel for thought.
Jet fuel.
Fuel injected.
Fuel for your business.
Welcome back, Rainmakers, to another Fuel podcast, the new business podcast brought to you in association with The Advertist, the new business development platform for creative, marketing, and communications agencies. Referrals are a great way to generate new business, but what happens when you want to grow your agency or something catastrophic like, a pandemic rocks your industry? You need a safety net, and that comes from having a pipeline of new business prospects that sit outside of your normal bubble. The Advertist has all the tools you need to build a solid pipeline of new business prospects to protect your agency when times get tough. Visit The Advertist at www.theadvertist.com. That's theadvertist.com for a free trial, or call the team on 0203 356 3717 today. But before we kick off this episode, let's stop by our resident new business oracle, Jeremy Davis, where he's got a thing or two to say about the dreaded agency process.
Jeremy Davis! New business trailblazer!
The trouble with agency processes is that they look good on paper and, as much as anything can, in a PowerPoint presentation. The problem when it comes to new business is that they're often not worth the undoubtedly expensive paper stock that they're written on. Look at this shiny process we use, the agency says, but then fail to relate it to any case studies or any of the work they've actually done. It's basically features, not benefits, the oldest selling no-no in the book, and comes just below the "look, we've got an office" slide in the standard game of agency credentials presentation bingo that's enlivened many a dull new business meeting for bored marketing managers wishing they'd stayed in their mate's band and followed their dream of becoming a rock star, and wondering if they could get on Britain's Got Talent without anyone from work finding out. They have no one but themselves to blame for this, of course, because it was the clients that started complaining sometime in the mid-90s that case studies no longer sufficed to set agencies apart, and that they needed to come up with new ways to differentiate themselves. Partly this was to do with the rise of procurement and the need for greater accountability, and to justify that all that lovely marketing money was going on something more concrete than some unspecified magical creative wizardry and a few long lunches at the Ivy. So suddenly, every agency had to have a process. And because the very notion of something so pseudo-scientific disgusted the nation's creative directors, it was left to the strategists to develop them. And they duly went nuts with their PowerPoint clip art, bar graphs and Venn diagrams, and produced the most flagrant abuse of British charts since Gaza's Fog on the Tyne got to number two. Needless to say, as with everything from the financial crisis of 2008, the struggles of high street retailers, and the underwhelming conclusion to smash hit BBC drama The Bodyguard, the internet is to blame for this, as clients made the perfectly reasonable argument that they could now view case studies on agency websites, eliminating the need to devote time and long hours to credentials presentations with no added value. The creatives continued to scorn the idea of anything so rigid as a process, although I did once hear one senior designer in a heated debate with his project manager about how he couldn't pull designs out of his arse. I'm not sure whether this was a reference to the standard creative process, but it does put a different slant on the well-known expression, polishing a turd, that you'll find on the timesheets of any creatives working with major supermarkets. Although I am personally sad that the exit from the UK of a certain low-cost Scandinavian retailer means that back of the netto will never become a thing in advertising. So, the creatives continued to shun the idea of processes, no matter what comes out of their backsides, and I've met a few designers that could talk for hours out of that particular part of their bodies, and the profound disconnect between what agencies claimed they followed as a process and the outcomes they actually produced continues. I know this because on the few occasions I have made a ham-fisted attempt to apply a process model to a prospect's business speculatively, it has been greeted warmly for the novelty it represented. As to the question of whether you can make such definitive statements based on anecdotal evidence from a few one-off examples, bear in mind that Costa Coffee's high-profile advertising campaign of a few years back, claiming that 8 out of 10 consumers preferred their coffee to Starbucks, was based on a sample size of 327, And you can bet they didn't mention that bit of the process in the credentials presentation. On top of that, it's never done Malcolm Gladwell any harm. On that note, I think this monologue has reached a tipping point, or at the very least, the point of no return.
Are people clear on marketing, and are people clear on the value that marketing's bringing? And by people, I mean your board, your staff, your investors. If those constituencies are not clear on the value of marketing, they're not clear on the role and value of marketing, if you want to build on it a different way, then don't be surprised when nobody's necessarily taking you that seriously. And especially don't be surprised when your budget becomes the first to be cut, because other professionals have done a better job of articulating the value that they bring than you have done.
This episode of The Fuel is a must if you're interested in career growth, because I speak to Phil Lewis, the man behind institution-challenging consultancy Corporate Punk. Phil was one of our first guests back in April, and my, how we've all adapted in a short amount of time. Phil is back to help us all understand why the transition from CMO to CEO is nearly always one of the most difficult feats to pull off career-wise. In the world of new business, and with CMOs as one of our primary prospects, it's important to understand what role we can play in helping to elevate their careers. And while it's always good just to shoot the shit, I thought it's best to get straight to the point and ask Phil to tell us five reasons why CMOs don't make good CEOs and what we can do to put this right. So if you want to understand the needs of your prospects, stay tuned while Phil Lewis takes the stage at The Fuel. So you're a CMO, Chief Marketing Officer, the toppest of the top at your game. You've got fiscal responsibility, sometimes with loads of zeros attached to it, and you run teams of people and coordinate suppliers. More than likely, you're also putting in the hours, way more than most of your colleagues, and yet you're not quite good enough to be the boss. Time and time again, having worked in the marketing industry for over three decades, I've seen and heard of CMOs getting the old popo, pissed on and passed over. So what is it that stops a CMO becoming the CEO? Why do CFOs and COOs overthrow the CMO for the CEO? I had a bunch of questions, and in my quest for answers, I'm taking you on a pilgrimage up the corporate mountain seeking advice from the man who puts the PH in company profit and an E and removes the F, and the, if you know what I mean. Anyway, he makes predictions in business and his advice is sound. He was my special guest all those episodes ago when we were all rookies at this podcasting thing. And now look at us, 20 odd episodes in, and we're long overdue to check in with Phil Lewis. When we last caught up with him, he was in the damn torpedoes mode, railing against any chance of pandemic-related recession. Since then, he's been coaching business leaders through the crisis with a mixture of good old-fashioned common sense and innovative top-down thinking. We were chatting the other day about a new initiative he's been working on that's part career coach and part psychologist that identifies hurdles that many of today's CMOs have to face in order to make the next and most daunting of leaps into the captain's chair. So I asked him to come on the show and give us his top five reasons why he thinks CMOs don't make good CEOs, and to help you meet the moment when it comes. So welcome again, Phil Lewis.
Hello, welcome, Keith.
Welcome, Phil. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. How are you?
Yes, I'm very well. I hope that since we last spoke, all is still well at Corporate Punk Towers.
All is always well at Corporate Punk Towers. I think doing the work that... No, but honestly, doing the work that we do, there is no such thing as a dull day, for the simple reason that there is no such thing as a dull human being on the planet, right? I mean, people are interesting. The way that they build businesses is interesting, and therefore the work we do is always interesting. So no, every day is a joy doing this kind of work.
Always positive. Well, before we kick off, I got to say, Phil, you called it right at the very start of this pandemic. You said that the only way to survive this kind of pole shift was to keep our heads down and keep blasting through. And so are you surprised that we're still not out of the woods yet?
No, not in the slightest. I mean, I think that this is the decade, right? So what has happened in the early part of 2020 sets the pace for the rest of the 2020s. In the same way, by the way, that 9/11 set the pace for the early 2000s, and the 2008 credit crunch set the pace for pretty much everything up to and including the pandemic. So we are not out of the woods at all. And actually, it's going to be a really, really long economic struggle, I think, for probably the rest of the decade. I think we'll see boom time again in the 2030s, probably. And most economists who I look at and rate would I think, are saying that. But in the short term, no, I think we've got a really challenging, 7 to 10 years ahead of us now, beyond any kind of health and social related issues, which may or may not be over in 12 to 18 months. But, you only have to look at the rates of money being printed, and you only have to look at the rate of business failures, unemployment in the US and so on to go. We are not at the beginning of what this means economically yet.
No. Well, I used the word pole shift in the introduction there. And it's really because, I mean, I kind of see it as a shift in polarity from what we did know to what we're learning now in terms of how businesses, sort of stand on their own 2 feet. It's almost like learning to walk again for a lot of companies.
Yeah, I would agree. And, we can talk about this later on, and I'm sure we will, but there is a massive opportunity in all of that. I think companies that can configure themselves to be responsive, resilient, and innovative. And there is a formula, there is a way of doing that. There are structural and systemic things that you can do to build responsiveness, resilience, and innovation potential. Those are the companies that are going to survive and thrive over the next 10 years, as indeed they've been the companies that have survived and thrived over the last 20 years. But that's just come more fully into focus now. And, we're going to talk about marketeers today, but one of the things I believe is, both the challenge and opportunity in businesses is that the people who can think creatively, who are ingenious, who've got, who are good at coming up with original answers to difficult questions, that skill set is going to be needed hugely over the next 10 years as we continue to face into uncertainty. But, there is no reason to be glum about this. I mean, one, being glum doesn't serve you anyway. I'm sure we spoke about that last time. And secondly, actually, there's going to be opportunity for the people and the businesses that are minded to try and take it, So it's game on, frankly. And, you either want to be part of that conversation or you don't. But I'm assuming anybody listening to a podcast called The Fuel wants to be part of it,
So what's been your, if you could pick on one thing, what do you think's been your biggest learning moment from all that's just happened?
I just think the extent to which the coronavirus pandemic has shown businesses for what they are and people for what they are. I think it's shone a very, very unforgiving light on businesses all over the world and on leaders all over the world and the people working for those businesses. And I think, there are businesses out there that have had incredibly tough situations and have behaved impeccably. They've behaved in line with their values. They've done the best that they've known how to do, sometimes facing almost impossible circumstances. And there have been businesses out there that have belied their own values, that have taken kind of heritage and legacy bypasses. They've shown themselves to not, frankly, be very well behaved when the chips were down. And I think that kind of way that the world has been divided up, I think there are businesses that will prosper out of this because their reputations have been enhanced as a result of what's happened. I think there are businesses whose reputations have probably been crippled with consumers and with their employees. And that, I think, has been the big thing for me is, forgetting entertainment, travel, hospitality, those huge categories, but they've had a generational event here. I mean, that's a huge thing that they've had to deal with. Forgetting them for a second, there have been a load of other businesses that their latent strengths and their latent weaknesses, they've just been brought fully into the light by this pandemic. And I think people will have very, very long memories for the businesses that have treated their people well and very long memories about the businesses that have treated their people and their consumers badly. And that, for me, has been a huge insight through this whole process, both not only as a professional, by the way, but actually also as a consumer.
As a consumer, yeah, of course. I mean, because we all get touched by it, and I think it's interesting listening to you just there. Is that we thought we had experience of some bad times, a year ago. We thought we were talking, we thought that we could look back on this with some, with some experience and say, well, we know how to weather the bad times. But then a pandemic comes along and just resets absolutely everything, doesn't it?
It really does. And, you know, and look, I've sort of said this already, and I probably said this to you when we spoke a couple of months ago, and I will continue to repeat it until I'm blue in the face. This is not unprecedented, right? This is very much precedented. You know, pandemics have precedence. Huge economic events have precedence. And within that, you know, there's liberation, there's emancipation, there's empowerment, because, you know, when we understand that things have precedent, we also understand that there are playbooks. There are things that people have done in the past that have worked and haven't worked that we can, you know, that we can learn from and we can, you know, move forward with. But for me, it's, you know, it's that thing also of, let's not forget, Keith, that, you know, again, in this world, of, it's not unprecedented, how do I put this? That this has happened three times in the last 20 years. 9/11, credit crunch, coronavirus pandemic. Between that, we've had Brexit, we've had sovereign debt crises in Greece, we've had banking crises, we've had fires, we've had floods, we've had Fukushima, you know, we've had currencies seesawing around all over the place. We've had corporate defaults, right? So many things have been happening, and you know, that is the world in which we live in. We kid ourselves that the world in which we're living in is not a world of constant change. It is a world of constant change. Change is not something that just you as a corporate choose to do when the mood takes you. It is the reality of being a human being on the planet. And you're either building an organization which is capable of coping with that change, or you're not building an organization that's capable of coping with that change. If you're not, you're playing hit and hope with your and your team's future. And I, you know, I genuinely think that is the thing that we need to get real about. This word unprecedented robs us of our agency. We are not here to be robbed of our agency. We are here to take full control of the things we can take control over and drive ourselves, our businesses, you know, our own careers, whatever, to new heights if we're ambitious people. So we have to get real about the fact that change is going to be a constant, and it's certainly going to be a constant over the next 10 years. So if you embrace that, walk towards that, I believe that that's the kind of, you know, the foundation for success.
Man, that sounded like a campaign speech, Phil.
Well, I'm not running for office.
Well, it's one of the things I loved about
That's not going to work, Keith, to be honest. I mean, we all know I'm a very, very talented consultant, but I would be a dreadful politician because I don't have it in me to, well, I just don't have it in me to how do I put it, talk out of both sides of my mouth, I think would be the polite thing to say, wouldn't it?
Well, maybe that's the maybe that's what's needed from politicians moving forward. But I mean, the point to it was that, you know, when this first came crashing down, I mean, you know, we'll talk about it like it was years ago, but it was only a matter of days, really. I mean, we're talking about, you know, 90 to 100 and, you know, 100 and something days ago, that when all this happened, that you kind of staged a whole bunch of events, you know, for executives that kind of doubled as a bit of a safe haven and a sounding board for them to be able to kind of vent their sort of concerns. I mean, what was the intention of the Fight Back Forum? What sort of drove you to do that?
Well, the Fight Back Forum was part of a bigger thing we did called Recession Rebellion. And within, I think, about 2 or 3 days of the lockdown taking place, I got my team together and I was like, look, there's fundamentally two ways you can deal with something like this, right? Way number one is we sort of shut up shop. You know, the ocean's going to be, like, to mix metaphors wildly, the ocean's going to be a bit choppy for the next 6 months, 12 months, whatever. So let's just literally gather everything in, shut up, and then we'll just sort of bob along and do the best that we can with the clients we've got. That's one option. The other option is let's be human beings who have got value to add, and let's be good and let's be kind and let's give away as much as we possibly can. And, you know, I genuinely believe, again, like values-led organizations, and we are a values-led organization, your values are the things that cost you, right? Your values are the things that really are what you do when the chips are down. And we went, okay, how do we get as much useful stuff into as many people's hands as possible, as quickly as possible? So that was what we called Recession Rebellion. I think I spoke about it last time we talked about. And if not, it's still available. Like, you can Google it, it's on YouTube, but there's loads of webinars up there or whatever. And there was webinars, there was forums. I'll talk about those in a sec. There was, came on other people's podcasts. I have a column for Forbes I repurposed. There was a whole bunch of stuff.
Now you're all over the place in terms of coverage.
Well, I've got to tell you, I think me and the team, we created something like 100, we did something like 130 things in 3 months, you know?
Wow.
And content-wise, I think we originated something like 85 pieces of content. It was something insane like that. And it was exhausting, back to the values of the things that cost you things. But, you know, we reached over 130,000 people with that. And for me, I go, okay, well, if just some of that in some small way help people at a really tough time, I would do it again in a heartbeat, you know?
Right.
And it really was just, it was just an attempt to try and help, because I do think when things get tough, you either close down or you open up. And my determination and the team's determination was to open up fully. And the forums were really just an attempt to get CEOs together and other senior leaders, you know, people, other people in the C-suite and at the director level, for a series of conversations about what was going on for them. And, you know, again, it was an amazing reminder to me that behind these quite inhuman things called organizations, and they can feel very remote and very big and very mechanistic. There are real human beings there, and
with feelings.
Sometimes real human beings with feelings who are suffering quite a lot, and they're called things like CEO, you know. And I think that was an interesting thing to be reconnected to. And I would say, look, I mean, I am someone who, you know, I do this for a living. I consult with and coach and train CEOs and directors in organizations on how to lead and manage change, Keith.
Right.
And that's what I do for a living, and it's what my team do for a living. And that's why I mean there's never a dull day. But the day that I start to treat people like robots, the day I don't see the human being that I'm sat with is the day I'm going to hang it up. But it's been very, very raw over the last few months, very raw for a lot of people. And the forums were as raw as anything I think I've seen in terms of a group setting in the last 5 or so years.
Yeah. And certainly, I mean, it was this was a pressure cooker moment for a lot of people. And I think it certainly sorted the runners from the runners from the losers. But with this new initiative that we're talking about today, we'll come onto that in a moment. But I mean, could you just kind of set the scene for us and outline how you came to the conclusion that CMOs kind of need help with their career path or their skill set? What triggered all that?
Let me start by saying something controversial, which is I really couldn't care less about the career path of CMOs, right? I mean, I have no dog in the CMO fight, right? Who cares? You know, look after yourself at one level. What I do deeply care about, though, is that we build organizations that are responsive, resilient, and innovative. Because organizations that are responsive, resilient, and innovative, if their values are good, big if, but if their values are good, they do good things for their people, they do good things for their customers, they do good things for the planet.
Right.
So I'm interested in how do we build really good businesses. Now, I then come back to who in business is used to being responsive, resilient, and innovative. And I look at the CMO, and we'll talk more about this later on, but I look at the CMO and I go, well, hang on a second, you are heading up one of the parts of the business where ingenuity, creativity, problem solving, those sorts of things are absolutely essential to what you and your team are doing.
It's part of their daily duties.
Correct. And for reasons I'm going to come on and talk about, I believe that, you know, that skill set, that approach, Keith, is absolutely central to what businesses in a broader sense need to survive and thrive. So although I don't champion CMOs over, to my point about no dog in the fight, I don't champion them more than I would champion a CMO, a CFO, somebody who's in corporate strategy, whatever. They don't deserve special treatment just for being a CMO, if you see what I mean.
Sure.
What I do think is that a lot of CMOs possess skills that if they are purposed in a broader leadership context have huge value to add at the moment. So I think that conversation about why is it CMOs don't become CEO is not because I'm sitting there going, you know, I really care about the future of the CMOs en masse, but I really care about some of the things that CMOs bring to the table. And I think they are unique and rare skills, and we can make better use of them organizationally if we choose to do so. So that's the reason I want to have this discussion.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, I see where you're going with it, because obviously, I mean, I guess sort of, that if you were going to continue the animal sporting analogy, if there was a horse that you were going to back out of, you know, who would be who would have the right skill set to lead us all out of this, or to lead a business out of this, you look at the skill sets of a CMO and you think, well, those are kind of, a lot of those seem to be, you know, applicable to what's going on around here. So you put together five really good, strong reasons why, CMOs don't make great CEOs, and not only do you make the observation, you've got these solutions. So we're going to go through each of them in depth, and we'll recap them at the end of the show for anybody that just wants to skip right through to the last 5 minutes. And we'll also be detailing them in a sort of a fact sheet on the website anyway. So on to reason number one. Now this. I was reading through your sort of your information about this, and I think, to me, this is the primary reason why marketing leaders rarely get the keys to the golden bathroom, and it's very similar to the world of new business, which is that marketing is only kind of vital only some of the time, according to most boardrooms, which is interesting, because what we're experiencing now is an increased focus on the sort of marketing and sales functions. And maybe this is a time for CMOs to be kind of advancing their stock and their corporate worth. I mean, what do you think that marketing is, or why is marketing still regarded as a kind of a turn off and honorable sort of function? And what are the perils of doing this?
Well, before we get into that, can we just talk about your use of the phrase "the keys to the golden bathroom"? I don't know what sort of businesses you've worked in, Keith. I don't think I've seen a golden bathroom in most offices for quite some time. But if there was to be a golden bathroom in some of our client offices, I would surely want the keys to that. So, what a remarkable turn of phrase you've got. So look, I think in terms of to answer your first point. Look, I think marketing is wrongly still regarded as a second order management discipline. And I think the second reason that we're going to come on to starts to expand a little bit more why this is. But I would just say, I think if you ask people for a definition of marketing, right? You ask most non-marketeers for a definition of marketing, they would not be able to define it with anywhere near the precision that they would be able to define, say, finance or operations or sales.
Right.
So even if you go back to the basics, now, if you go to the Chartered Institute of Marketing's definition of marketing, which is to anticipate, identify, and satisfy consumer needs profitably, I think it is. If you go back to that definition, which is, I think, the gold standard definition for what marketing is, that actually is a pretty comprehensive management process that you've just summarized in that sentence, right? You've got to understand what needs are, you've got to be able to identify them, presumably as they change, and then you've got to work out how to satisfy those needs. Now, in satisfying those needs, again, the process of satisfying consumer needs actually takes in a lot. It can take product and service design in, it can take pricing in, it can take, you know, promotion in, which we'll talk more about, it can take positioning in, which is, you know, not only brand but at the product level, and so on. A lot is going on in that single sentence.
Right.
And yet, if you talk to a whole raft of marketeers, Keith, and ask them for a definition of what they do, they would stammer their way to talking about effectively the fact they run a comms department. And I'm talking even at the CMO level. A lot of CMOs are not crystal clear on precisely what they're definition of marketing for their organization is. And that level of confusion reigns, I think, broadly in organizations. If you cannot define something crisply and accurately, it is clearly not that important, right?
It's
clearly not that important, or else you would have done so. Now, let's look at how that works through. So we're going to talk more about another angle on this in a second. But if you look at an example then of what happens, let's look at the rise of the chief growth officer, right?
Yes.
Now, the rise of the chief growth officer is somebody, as far as I can see, who has basically co-opted a whole chunk of marketing, renamed it growth, and on we go. So there is a structural question a lot of organizations about why you need both. There is also other structural things happening, like, for example, product gets pulled out of marketing in too many organizations as well, particularly tech one. Now, ultimately, product definition, product design is a marketing discipline. It has to be. Anticipate, identify, and satisfy consumer needs profitably. You know, product would be a part of that. And so what you see is you start to see this like lack of structural integrity coming through, partly because of a misplaced definition of what marketing is. Now, clearly, there are sometimes good reasons from an organizational design point of view why it does make sense to pull marketing out as an adjacent, products as an adjacent discipline to, say, marketing. But in a lot of cases, I think what these things actually point to is just a baseline misunderstanding of what marketing is. So you fundamentally got a bunch of people, you know, you've got a CMO who is sitting there presiding over an ill-defined management discipline.
Right.
Now, you can agree, you can disagree with that. I'm going to build on a whole load of other points onto this. But if you cannot define what marketing is crisply, and if that is not shared across your business, do not be surprised when people start to treat you like you're slightly disposable.
Yes, that's a very interesting point. And it speaks to something that there's a common theme that keeps cropping up in this podcast is the need in most ideas and most concepts, for the sort of the singular crisp definition of, you know, the defining high concept of any theory. So, you know, and I keep going back to it, like, you know, the idea of Alien, the film, the movie Alien, being Jaws on a spaceship, you know, is that when you talk about a job function and you can't sum it up in one simple sentence, then, you know, you may well have a problem on your hands. And that's quite an interesting observation there. So in reason number two, and getting back into my movie themes again, this time with Cool Hand Luke, what we have here is a failure to communicate. Interestingly, the second reason that you cite for marketers not getting a fair crack of the whip is a problem of their own making. CPM, CPT, OTS, UX, UA, CSR, brand equity, and all those sorts of things are a part of an exclusive language. Just to prove that I do my research here, a bit like the language Njerep, which is a Bantoid language spoken in Nigeria by only four people. And so in this respect, a marketer's their own worst enemy for using a language that nobody can understand. And how can they parlay their achievements into boardroom speak?
Well, there is value in having a shared language around what's being done in marketing within marketing, right?
Right.
The language of brand strategy, brand equity, UX, all those things, they have value in the context of being able to strategize and execute, you know, what you're trying to do in marketing.
Right.
The fundamental problem, though, is that a lot of marketeers aren't speaking the language that the boards can actually hear.
Yes.
So. You know, if you, to give you an example of this, we can talk about building brand equity. Now, building brand equity requires us to create a set of brand associations and drive awareness around those associations. Mm-hmm. That's the process of really what building brand equity is, if you go to the Byron Sharp kind of model of what it actually means to build brands. Now, what then needs to happen, and this is where the work often doesn't get done because it's complex, technical, boring, and requires investment, is to work out a kind of attribution model that says, effectively, for every pound we invest in building brand equity, here are the pounds, shillings, and pence that come out the bottom. right? So or to put it another way, every pound we invest here, here's the top line, bottom line growth that will result, right?
Right.
Too often what happens is that the job of actually working through, which is tremendously difficult in some cases, there's a concept called hypothecation in charity, which is about when you give a pound to a charity, how can you actually say where that pound ends up, right? Because there's so many different ways it can flow through an organization and so many different, especially big charities, so many different ways it can end up. And it's the same in marketing sometimes, right? Which is that, you know, it's not to say it's easy work. It can be very, very hard to say, here is the pound you spent on building brand. Here is the pound of turnover or profit that results. That work doesn't get done, though, or enough attention doesn't get paid to that stuff. And so, again, when we're talking about why is it CMOs don't make CEO, well, a CEO needs to be incredibly fluent in the language of shareholders, investors, return on investment,
right,
return on capital, all that kind of stuff. Most marketeers simply aren't. And if you cannot justify the spend that you are making within your own team, your own department, and you can't translate that into language that boards can hear, you know, on top of the fairly wafty definition of marketing that exists in a lot of organizations, you start to see where the problem lies. Now, we're going to take this up a number of different gears before we're through, but I just want to start with those two foundational points, because are people clear on marketing and are people clear on the value that marketing is bringing? And by people, I mean your board, your staff, your investors. If those constituencies are not clear on the value of marketing, they're not clear on the role and value of marketing, if you want to build on it a different way, then don't be surprised when nobody's necessarily taking you that seriously. And especially don't be surprised when your budget becomes the first to be cut, because other professionals have done a better job of articulating the value that they bring than you have done. And I'm sorry, I know I'm being very direct here, but, you know, like,
we wouldn't have it any other way.
This is the conversation. It's me. It's like, that's the discussion. Now, there is a danger, and I'll shut up in a sec, but there is a danger that one can talk a bit too generalistically here. There are organizations and types of business that do this very well. In FMCG, for example, in the P&G Unilever mode, then marketeers are very, very used to conversations around, they're much, much more commercial, right? They are used to brand equity as a commercial lever that they're pulling. They're very, very good at understanding the relationship between money out, money in, all that kind of thing. And actually, they are marketing-focused organizations, because that's what most FMCGs are. They take a product and their job is to package and sell it. But in a huge number of other industries, whether it's FS, whether it's retail, whether it's B2B, whether it's tech, that skill set does not exist. And I'm arguing here that in the majority of cases, that skill set doesn't exist, and it is holding marketeers back from being able to bring their truest value to their client organizations, which is where I think, you know, the conversation needs to go next, and actually where I think it becomes really genuinely interesting.
That's a very interesting point, because, you know, very rarely, I mean, you know, I've been in sort of fairly senior sort of marketing and sales roles, but very rarely do you get exposed to the shareholders and the upper echelons, you know, of the company. And it occurred to me that I wonder whether that is down to a kind of an internal fear of exposing you to these people, or whether you're going to sort of they're afraid that you're sort of going to talk about things that they're not interested in. So, you know, it does seem to be a common thing that they are kind of, there is a firewall between the shareholders and the more senior members of staff or members of the team in a company and the sort of marketing team, do you think?
Potentially, but I would throw that challenge right back to senior marketeers and go, if you're not getting airtime with shareholders, what is missing from the story that you're telling, whether it's data or models or whatever else? Because in the end, let's be very, very clear, you know, brands have value.
Right.
We know they have value. We can intuit it, Keith. I mean, look at Google, Apple, Nike, Amazon, look at any organization which is globally renowned. I'm not going to say admired, but or globally famous, probably the better word. We understand that brands have value. So if how we manage brands isn't a top table conversation, if it's something that shareholders don't seem to be interested in, or your boss isn't interested in you sharing with the shareholder, I think the question has to be, what's missing from the story that we're telling that allows us to get that top table place? Because marketing is not a marginal discipline in the vast majority of 21st century businesses. It's hugely important.
Yeah.
So it's like always a useful discipline. This is where my northernness comes through, I suppose. It's like when something's going wrong, first ask what your own contribution to it is. And I think that would be something to explore in this one. You know, the boss won't let me be in front of the shareholders. Well, boo-hoo. How are you contributing to that particular situation? Like, what is it that you are doing or not doing, sins of omission or commission, that are holding you back from doing that? Because most shareholders I've met, good ones, engaged ones, are people who are going, no, please do talk to me about how we're managing brand, because if we're not managing it well, actually we're only damaging the future of our business. So there's no reason that conversation shouldn't be happening.
Great. Well, so I mean, in reason three, the role of a marketer, whether it's B2B or B2C, is to make sure that the company's products or services are kind of packaged in such a way that the audience kind of understands its role in their lives, the marketing's primary objective is mass communication. And yet, kind of despite being kind of masters of this type of communication, they always tend to, or they often, not always, but miss one really important channel. And so could you just explain what that is and what they need to do in order to take a seat at the highest table?
Well, again, it's not even one channel, by the way, it's multiple, but or multiple audiences, we should say. Right, let's go to the world of the CEO. The world of the CEO involves anticipating, identifying, and satisfying the needs of a whole range of constituencies.
Right.
Stakeholders, shareholders. Stakeholder being slightly different from a shareholder because they, a regulatory body can be a stakeholder, for example, but not a shareholder. Stakeholders, shareholders. Employees, partner organizations, partner businesses, those different constituencies, the management of those, never mind a customer, right, for a second, the management of those constituencies is a huge job for almost every CEO. So marketeers can be very kind of monomaniacal, right? And this is a good thing, right? It's a really good thing in one sense. They're monomaniacal, which means they focus on one thing, and that one thing is the customer, right? We need to find out what the customer wants, and we need to make sure we're meeting that need in our marketing.
Right.
And then to the extent that they engage with the other constituencies, they engage with them because they need something from them, be that budget, or be that buy-in or whatever, what they're not necessarily doing is taking a lead front and center in the management of those constituencies. And the expertise in managing those constituencies is one of the things that will delineate a CEO from the other roles. CFOs, for example, have more exposure to some of those other constituencies than CMOs typically would do, right? So.
But do you think that the CFO might get more involved or more exposed to these people because they talk a very, very specific language, and you can't afford to get that wrong. So,
well, totally, Keith. But also, it's like CFOs. If you look at organisations that say employ 2,500 to 5,000 people, then your CFO is going to have a huge level of input into the formulation of employment policy, for the simple reason that the employment policy will, massively affect the P&L. Your marketeer probably isn't.
Right.
Your marketeer probably isn't. But, and this is the interesting thing, think about what marketeers are good at. right? Marketeers are really good at persuasion. Marketeers are really good at behavior change. Those things are really important in the management of constituencies other than the consumer, right? So there are persuasion and behavior change jobs to do with internal audiences, such as employees. There can be persuasion and behavior change jobs to do with stakeholders, sometimes with shareholders, certainly persuasion, and sometimes with stakeholders as well, right? So the marketeer's skill set, this is what's interesting, the marketeer's skill set actually can have a direct application with those other audiences. What marketeers aren't doing is lobbying for their skill set to have an application with those audiences. And actually so many businesses are kind of so sort of myopic and so in the weeds in the everyday, and people are so busy trying to just cope with their roles that no one's lifting their heads up and going, well, hang on a second, Bob who runs marketing or Rachel who runs marketing, actually what they bring could be incredibly useful in an internal management context, and they're not doing that. And I suppose the travesty of it is back to this gap between CMO and CEO again, that ability to persuade, that ability to affect behavior change could actually be tremendously valuable at the CEO's table. Do you see what I mean? If you were to allow it to sort of get there. But again, marketeers aren't thinking that way, and I don't think boards and stakeholders and shareholders are thinking that way. So CMOs end up more landlocked than perhaps they deserve to be.
Is this an evolutionary thing? Is this something that has, because I would say that out of all of the main skills within at a boardroom table, the marketing is probably the youngest of the skills. I mean, do you think that with a lot of companies that it's not deemed grown up enough yet?
Well, but that's back to the previous point, right? If you can't articulate the value you're bringing in the world, and you can't define yourself crisply, you don't feel like a mature discipline. Do you see what I mean? Right? You just don't. You feel like a nice to have, not a need to have, or you feel like there's more work to be done. Right?
Right.
So I think that's right. There is a broader point, and do, Keith, pull me back from this because I could disappear from this rabbit hole for a while, but I just want to share it. It's really important. We have to think about education. So, you know, I sit on the board of I'm a strategic advisor to, actually, these days, the founders of originally a school and now an educational trust, who focus on teaching children project management, creative thinking, collaboration, project management, and like oracy, so speaking skills, right?
Right.
Now, those are the things that people need to survive and thrive in the 21st century, our ability to collaborate, to create. And I'm going to come on and talk about this in point four in some greater detail. But it is that ability to think creatively, that ability to move laterally where others will only move logically, that actually is so, so, so important. The point I want to make here, though, is that being a creative thinker, being a marketeer, then, if you will, which is a creative discipline at its best, as well as an executional one, does not have the status of some of the other disciplines. It doesn't have the status of finance, for example.
Sure.
Partly because we train people in reading, writing, arithmetic at school. We do not train them in the creative disciplines. We don't put status in our education around the sort of things that marketeers specialize in. We put status in the other things. So yes, you are correct about the immaturity of it, but I also think, Keith, that there is a real problem, and I'm going to talk about why this is so central in a few minutes. There is a real problem around what we're actually teaching people to do at school, what we put high status around. And marketing is still not seen as a high status discipline. I believe that. And I think there is roots for that in how we teach children way back to school. But not only marketing, by the way, you can talk about the whole creative industries in that context as well.
Right. No, I love that. I think you're so right. I mean, it isn't one of those things that gets ingrained in us right at the very start of things. It's something that kind of gets adopted later on. But well done for not stepping down that rabbit hole for too long. But the fourth reason, and this is one that I love, because it involves our mutual friend Tom Cheesewright, because he outlined in his his new book, which I'll gladly plug, How to Future-Proof Your Business, he claimed that the next wave of commercial success is going to come from businesses that display the best agility and the best adaptability. And certainly, obviously, a pandemic is probably one of the greatest tests of how businesses need to change their models to adapt to a new kind of like minimum contract, socially distanced, e-commerce driven world. And another one of my previous guests, Gordon Lee, said that basically if your business is hospitality, then overnight your turnover has just dropped 60%, which means that marketing has now got a lot of heavy lifting to communicate how the difference can be recovered. So what value can marketers add to a business in transition?
Right. So Tom is right on that whole point about agility, but Tom is far from the first person to have talked about this. So I don't mean that with zero disrespect. Like he's a mutual friend, and I think he does some very, very valuable work.
Indeed.
Yeah. But the concept of the adaptive organization goes back to 1980s management thinking. But if you come to like 2013, 2014, the HBR, which I tend to regard as a sort of Ministry of the Bleeding Obvious publication, but the HBR published a very interesting article that said there's three rules for making a company great, right? Now, rule one was to prioritize increasing revenues over decreasing costs. Right. Rule two was to compete on differentiators other than price. And rule three was ignore all of the rules apart from rules one and two. Right. Now, if you come up and out of that for a second, what that is actually saying is that it is organizations that are responsive, resilient, and innovative and have the potential to innovate that will survive and thrive. That's what that's actually saying. Outthink, outmaneuver the competition. That's a team game. Right. Now, back to what we were talking about with marketeers earlier on. Most marketeers I know are really original thinkers who can understand in the context of crowded, aggressive, noisy marketplaces, how to find competitive advantage in how they position and proposition their products and how they then take those products to market, right? Mm-hmm. They are finding, you know, sometimes they've got like barely a cigarette paper that can go between one competitor and the next, and they still manage to do that job, you know, very, very well. That skill set, that ability to spot original answers to difficult questions, to think, you know, laterally when the rest of the world thinks literally, is really valuable. But it is not now just valuable at the level of marketing strategy. It is valuable at the level of business strategy. And not only from a CEO point of view, CEO responsible in the end, don't forget, for business strategy, but also configuring an organization to deliver on that business strategy. So the organization needs to be configured to be responsive, resilient, and innovative. And I believe that marketeers have got real value to add there if they can learn about how to drive that sort of change through their organizations.
Yeah.
But innately, they are people for whom, you know, they are original creative thinkers. And it is the scaling or the industrialization of creativity, just a way of saying problem solving. Let's not get, you know, hang tied on that word. Mm-hmm. That creativity is absolutely central to business success. And it is the marketeers who I believe are naturally amongst, not always the most, but amongst the most creative in an organization, which means at least they deserve a shot at being CEO if they can prove and find a way to mobilize that capability in organizational development and business strategy terms.
So it's very much a case of using the knowledge that lies at the very heart of marketing and applying it to a different set of problems within a business at a higher level.
So the stuff I teach, right? So there are all sorts of reasons, Keith, why it is very, very hard to build a resilient, responsive, and innovative organization. And there are reasons that are complex to do with human psychology, that go to concepts like risk aversion, the nature of the ego, our inability to think systemically, empathy gaps, we don't understand how we're going to feel in the future, all that sort of stuff. We end up building organizations that actually we want them to be agile, but in the desire to control complexity, which is what comes with growth, and for various psychological reasons and to do also with our own weaknesses and blind spots as human beings, we actually end up building sclerotic, slow-moving, dysfunctional organizations. So the whole ends up being a whole lot less than some of the parts. So my work and the work of my team is all focused on how do you overcome those barriers? How do you get out of your own way so that your organization can be responsive, resilient, and innovative, and do so at scale, right? That is the nature of the work. Now, for me, as I said, marketeers have some natural skills there that people in other disciplines might lack or be less evolved in, for the simple reason that marketeers have been having to think innovatively to do what they do for years. And they've often built teams of people around them who are capable of doing that. So they've already demonstrated some ability to kind of like scale that capability within the organization. The job is they've got to be lifted up and out of that particular discipline.
Yep.
And they've got to learn how to do that in other disciplines and learn how to systematize some of that capability. It's not only marketeers that can do this, by the way, but my argument is that marketeers have some innate qualities that mean that they are well positioned to at least give it a good go.
No, I see. I understand that. But onto reason five. And I think more importantly, there's the ability to balance relationships and to do the sort of touchy-feely stuff. And despite the role of marketing sort of being to manage commercial relationships, I mean, you claim that there's a perception that marketers often fall short in terms of the ability to lead their own troops. Why is that? And what can they do about it?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that we have a gap in, talked about education earlier on. We also, not only do we have a gap in our education provision at school level, we also have one at an exec level as well. So a lot of people end up being promoted. This isn't just marketeers, Keith, right? A lot of people end up being promoted into very senior positions without ever really have much in the way of leadership development at all, right? And you know, they end up being, sometimes people are just good politicians, they score highly on the dark triad of personality traits and whatever, or they end up just through sheer kind of force of will and indeed competency in their core discipline rising on that basis. But very, very, very rarely do people at a senior level actively invest in their own leadership development outside of an occasional bit of coaching or whatever else, right? And that's certainly true of marketeers. I've met a lot of senior marketeers, marketing directors, CMO levels, who have got there. They're really good, really hardworking, really bright, really creative, really good at behavior change, pretty good at persuasion, haven't actually really worked out how to become that kind of rounded leader. And, you know, CEOs, I heard the CEO, the then CEO of Coca-Cola speak about 5 or 10 years ago. And he said something that sort of struck me as quite significant, albeit it was quite a sort of passing comment.
Right.
He said, my job is really to influence those around me so they lead the business better. And that's interesting for two reasons. One, somebody who's in charge of an organization sees his job primarily as influence. And the second thing was stated in his sentences, the idea that, you know, he's not really doing any of the leading, it's others who are doing it. His job is just to make them better leaders.
He's enabling them, yeah.
But he's making them better leaders, right? He's almost the leader of the leaders. So the job in that context, then you go to the world of the marketeer, and I'm only talking about marketeers because that's what I'm, you know, we're talking about today, but I do believe it applies in the context as well. Show me who is developing outstanding leadership in business, right? You see people going on exec coaching courses, for example, or occasional leadership courses, and you know, they're not really growing the rounded skill sets. So the fifth point I am landing is I'm saying there is a lack of credible, training and leadership development available in the marketplace to help the marketeers make the transition transition that they need to make in to or they want to make to CEOs. Now, now look at the available help, right? Let's look at the available help for a second. So you fundamentally got three sources of help, right? Source of help number one, the business press. Generic, mostly fairly low level, lot of Ministry of the Bleeding obvious sort of stuff. It's like needle in a haystack. Second source, business schools. So you can go off to INSEAD or to, you know, Harvard or to the LSE or whatever else and learn there and do MBAs and all the rest of it. Now, the problem with that is it's teaching a lot of the time abstract technical stuff. It isn't teaching the human stuff, right? So in other words, if you go the job of driving any kind of organizational change or development is you've got to combine the human and the technical. So if you think about that in day-to-day language, you would go set a strategy for what you're trying to do and persuade people it's the right thing to do and keep them with you on the journey of delivery, right? That's the human and the technical in more kind of day-to-day language. So business schools will teach you the technical and they'll teach it to you in a really abstract way. And often the people who are doing the teaching there haven't actually been in industry, as they call it, for years and years. Right. So not that helpful. And then, or certainly not comprehensive. I don't want to speak of like, you know, like some of the London Business School and the Harvard, all the rest of it. These are very, very august institutions that do what they do very, very well. But we just have to acknowledge that it's not a comprehensive approach. And right. on the side of it, if people stuff's interesting to you, you can go off on like exec coaching courses, which will teach you a load of stuff, which will probably feel quite, you know, only tangentially related to your role as a CMO will get you a lot better at the people side of it, but actually it can be quite hard to understand how then to apply that in the context of the role you've got from a day-to-day point of view. So my simple point is for senior execs who are trying to make the transition, you've got to, there's a gap for a type of training and leadership development, which brings together the practical and the technical, that brings the human and the technical, that is practical and grounded, not just theoretical, and which actually meets people where they're at from a needs perspective in terms of real problems that they've got going on in their business right now. And I think that missing link from a professional development point of view is holding back the ability of some very capable people to get the keys to the gold bathroom.
Okay. All right. Well, look, I tell you what, let's just recap where we got to. Okay. So just to make sure that obviously I understand where we are. So we got five reasons why CMOs don't make good CEOs are: number one, perception. Marketing needs to be seen as a business critical function all of the time. Agree?
I agree.
Right. Two, communication. Parlaying the marketing KPIs as part of the corporate strategy.
Yes.
Three, focus on the internal as well as the external audience.
Yes.
Four, use creativity to help the company overcome business objectives.
I would say institutionalize an ability to problem solve in order to become more responsive, resilient, and innovative. That's how I would say number four.
Okay, cool. And number five, develop leadership and change management skills.
Correct.
Great. Okay. Well, I got 4 out of 5, I guess.
You got 5 out of 5. I was just simply, if I just sit here going, yes, like nodding.
No, I know.
It's less interesting, isn't it?
Well,
our lovely listeners.
This is great food for thought. And I hope that you've obviously raised some very good points. So, I mean, okay, so what's the call to action here, Phil? What do CMOs need to do about it? And how do you get involved?
Well, firstly, any CMO who's listened to this or any senior marketeer who's listened to this, I would love to have a discussion with you about it, right? If your career or your business's future, you would like to take that top table role, you should absolutely give us a shout on that. You can find us anywhere, corporatepunk.com, not hard to find anybody on the internet, as I always say. But the more fundamental thing, you know, we've just launched something called the Change Course. Now, the Change Course is for senior execs. It's not just for marketeers. It can be for people in ops and finance as well. But people who are at that C-suite level or at that senior director level who are looking to get good at being able to manage transformation and change, understand the need to do that with the people they've got, and are looking for a form of leadership development that combines the, you know, the human and the technical, that is much more practical and grounded than what else is, you know, what else is available out there, and is built of tools and techniques that are proven to drive successful change in organizations, because we at Corporate Punk have been using them for years. That Change Course is, the first one rolls out in October. There's also a cohort in January for larger organizations who may want to do that for multiple people in their organization. We can also come into your organization and deliver that as well. So if you go to corporatepunk.com, you will see both in the menu, I think, but also on our services page, you will see the Change Course there. And there's a lot of information about that. And I would really suggest that anybody who's interested, not only in making that leap to CEO, because that may or may not be right, but certainly interested in being able to lead and manage change in their organization, would find tremendous value in that course.
Great. And I mean, obviously, look it up and read all the information that you've got. But I guess more importantly, just give you a call, because I mean, the conversation, you know, is always going to be much richer that way.
You know, I think you can get me on LinkedIn as well. And, you know, we are a coaching and consulting organization as well as a training one. And, you know, as I said earlier on around the stuff we're doing with Recession Rebellion and the 5x Forum, our business grows through referrals. We have a 90% client retention rate, you know, because Fantastic. We focus on doing the right thing by the businesses that we work with, and we try and be additive in every conversation that we have with people. So for me, it's, you know, it's always a great conversation. As I said earlier on, I'm welcoming of any contact from anybody, because I've never had a dull conversation with another human being in my life, you know. So
Fantastic.
So that's an open offer to anybody listening to this podcast.
Great. Well, look, any CMOs listening, check out Phil Lewis's company, Corporate Punk. Drop him an email and get connected. And you'll find all the touch points on the show notes for the website. Phil, thanks very much. Normally, we do a few kind of lifestyle and lighthearted questions, but I know you were keen to get a sort of a serious point across, and I do understand that. And that we are part of a bigger media tour. So there will be other broadcasts and podcasts that you're on. So if people want to get a different perspective on things, then check him out. So perhaps we can have you back on another time, and we can broaden our focus and loosen our stuffy little ties a bit then. But Phil, thanks again. Look after yourself, and we'll speak to you soon.
Thank you, Keith.
All right, you take care. Thanks a lot. This is a big takeaway. And just to confirm the train of thought, I've had several subsequent conversations about it with other people who all agree we need to provide a lot more clarity in our marketing language to help CMOs make their case in the boardroom. We're all guilty of overusing jargon and catchphrases that boggle and befuddle, when essentially we should be talking in clear, relatable company speak. Margins, profitability, ROI and cost analysis. Likes and followers mean nothing to a shareholder unless it translates to the bottom line. So, in this new hyper-focused marketing world, let's drop the flim-flam and pitch our wares in ways that help CMOs make our case to their peers. Because marketing is the only discipline that hides its light under a bushel of curiosity and confusion. Now, before we go, let me leave you with a little joke. A man walks into a bar with a set of jump leads around his neck. The barman looks at him and says, "I'll serve you this time, but you better not start anything." So join us next time on The Fuel, the new business podcast sponsored by The Advertist, the new business development platform, when we'll be entertaining you with songs and sketches and jokes old and new, as well as a healthy dose of insight for the new business curious. And really, shouldn't that include you?